Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Peter Hart, and with me is lovely Gary
Bain.
Bain.
What are we doing today, Pete?
Well, today we're doing... Well, it's a sad day, Gary. It's a sad day in two ways. One, it's the end of our second Fife and Forfar Yeomanry. I think that's right. Series of podcasts. I don't know how many there have been. Do you know?
Well, it feels like we've been doing it for about 3 years.
So, say 10.
There's been a lot.
They've been really interesting, and they've been a great bunch of lads. I remember interviewing them, and it's great to get their memories out to a bigger audience.
And anybody who wants to learn more could buy your book, Burning Steel.
Sausages.
Burning Steel, A Tank Regiment at War, 1939-1945. Much more in it than the Tank Regiment at War, 1959-68.
Yeah, there's bugger all in that one.
Unless you're Israeli, I suppose.
Now, so this one's called Epilogue, and it's basically, in the last episode, we'd had their VE Day celebrations on 8th of May, and there'd been a couple of slightly amusing tales of people getting paralytic drunk, which we disapproved of strongly.
And then they all, of course, went straight home.
No.
No, why not?
Why can't they go straight home? Well, they're part of an occupying army. They're responsible for maintaining order and actually to re-establish, well, not re-establish because you can't call the Nazis sound government, but to establish sound governance in a war-torn Germany.
Now, they moved to a base at a place called Bredstedt, which was near the east coast of Schleswig-Holstein and about 15 miles from the Danish frontier.
You've been near that area, haven't you?
I think I have, actually, thinking about it.
Now, what's their first big task, do you think, as a unit now? Because, I mean, they've still got jobs to do. What's their first big job?
Well, they've got to receive the hordes of German soldiers as they cross the border. They're falling back from their former role garrisoning both Norway and Denmark. Now, some of the men were amazed by the defiant martial attitude of some of their erstwhile opponents. And this is Trooper Ron Forbes of 4 Troop B Squadron. We lined the roads just outside Bredstedt when they were coming along. We were impressed. When they came towards the town, they all came to attention, marched at attention, and they were singing. Some of these marching songs the Germans had were very good, very inspiring. Some of the boys saluted them. I didn't salute them.
Bit of a Scottish didn't, was that, Gary?
Edinburgh, obviously.
Yeah, now there's another really... We referenced it in the last episode, the problem of the thousands of displaced persons that they'd been in the forced labour camps, the German forced labour camps. And so what do the squadrons do? They send men to these camps to try and keep order. Now, how does this go? It doesn't go. It's not a happy part of the story, is it? For anybody.
Sadly, as was often the case amongst the British occupying forces in post-war Germany, there was little of the natural sympathy that might have been expected for these poor, benighted victims of the German slave labour regime. And there was very little real concern as to what might happen to them once they were returned to their home countries, some of which were under Soviet control.
Yeah, where they had a poor outlook on life. This is what you're going to tell us, what Major Douglas Pinky Hutchison, who was at this time, I think, second in command of the whole regiment. What does he say?
We had a look after some large camps of displaced persons. We were supposed to entertain them. We played football against them. They were a mixture of anything from Eastern Europe. They were a miscellaneous, ill-disciplined, rather tiresome lot. They were repatriated during the summer. I suppose, poor souls, that when they were returned to Russia, they had a fairly sticky response.
And I think you and I both feel a bit... I mean, we know what that sticky is. It covers a multitude of vicious treatment and murder, basically. Yeah. Now, in the early days of the occupation, how are they getting on with the German civilians?
Well, there's a policy of strict non-fraternisation, and that was enforced to restrict social interaction as much as possible with the general population. However, it didn't last. And you're going to tell us what Corporal Roy Valance of 4 Troop A Squadron said.
One of our favourites. He says this: I was quite happy with it. I think most people were, because I didn't really have any great love for the Germans. All these years we've been taught to hate them, and the only good German is a dead one. But you can't really live amongst people and go on disliking them, particularly as they were in such a poor state. They had no food, no transport, most of their cities were bombed to smithereens. All these things start with the children. Then one thing leads to another. Soldiers give children sweets, then the parents start to talk to them, then things take their natural course. You just become friendlier. And that's almost every soldier I've ever interviewed from the occupation. They just get it. It does start with the children. So you can't really be nasty to kids, can you?
No, no.
No matter how much you hate the Germans, you don't hate German kids. And then, of course, it goes on.
Now, sadly, the regiment didn't survive long in its wartime state. The presence of the senior regiment, that's the 1st Fife and 4 Fife Yeomanry,
who we've sadly not mentioned at all, hardly,
there in Germany, and that meant that there was a large exchange of personnel, which tore the guts out of the unit.
Now, on 17th of June 1945, just all these men that we've followed for so long in these podcasts, they find themselves packed off in drafts to join the 1st Fife and 4 Fife Yeomanry. And what's more... Where are they? There's something. What's the elephant in the room? And for once, I don't mean you. What is the elephant in the room?
Well, they're told that they're bound for the Far East and the continuing war against the Japanese.
Yep, the war doesn't end with the Japanese.
Germans. Now, the young ones who'd not been in the army that long, and they'd been given a high demobilisation group number, and they were given no choice but to be drafted.
Now, men who'd been in the army longer and therefore had a lower demob number were given the chance to volunteer. Now, why might they want to volunteer to join the 1st, 54 Fives?
They're friends. They'd want to go wherever their friends were. And if they were moving into the 5 and 4 Fire Yeomanry, it's only natural you'd want to go with them.
Absolutely. And here's an example of one who actually was quite positive about the whole idea. And this is Jack Edwards. We've been following him for a while. And he joins the 1st 54 Fives. What does Jack Edwards say?
Well, I would just say before I read this that there's some language of the time in this that we would now think as inappropriate. But you've got to think about the emotional state they were in. This is war. And this is Trooper Jack Edwards. We were told all the young men of demobilisation groups above a certain number had to parade in a cinema on the Sunday morning to be addressed by the colonel. We were all there, all the younger end of us, and the colonel got on the stage and gave us a talk to say that we were all experienced soldiers who'd been in action at various times over the last 12 months, but that soon the regiment would be disbanded. But if any of us wanted to stay with the regiment and stay with their friends, we could transfer to the 1st Fife and Forfar, which was also in Germany, but which was due to go to the Far East. After this talk, a gang of us in our squadron gathered together and we said, well, the 1st Fife and Forfar have got crocodiles. We knew that. We hated the thought of the Japanese. Their name was mud as far as we were concerned. We said, let's go out and incinerate the yellow bastards. We all volunteered to go to the first Fife and Forfar. A day or two later, there was a convoy went with about 100 of us from the regiment. While we were on the way there, there was a similar number coming from the first Fife and Forfar, older men coming back to our regiment.
And what he's talking about is the crocodiles had flamethrowers. That's what he's talking. That's why he's talking about incinerating the Japanese. It's they were a nasty weapon. Now, one of those who volunteers, who would that be? Who would volunteer for anything?
Well, that was Steele Brownlee. Now, when we left him, he'd been injured and he'd recovered from his minor wound and the cheerful excesses of his brief leave back in the
what
UK.
What do you mean by cheerful excesses?
Happy excesses. Now, he'd managed to rejoin the regiment at Bredstedt on the 31st of May. And this is Captain William Steele Brownlee, now of the 1st Fife and Forfar Yeomanry.
Yeah, well, he would be, yeah. Colonel Alec informed me that I had volunteered to take part. The plan later unfolded. We would have crocodiles, flame-throwing Churchills, with which to burn stubborn Japanese in their pillboxes at a range of 100 yards as they tried to defend their homeland. We would fly to the UK, have 30 days leave, and then fly to the USA and link up with the tanks, which had gone ahead by sea. So that's the plan. That's what they're going to do.
Now, in the end, it's all cancelled when modern technology, which is an interesting way of putting it, brought the war to an abrupt end. And Captain William Steele Brownlee goes on to say,
two atomic bombs had spared us, average age 19 years, 6 months, as well as many others. Another conventional war. He means that they wouldn't have to go and fight, take the islands. I have never had any sympathy with those who take a one-sided view of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this is interesting because it's almost impossible for us to understand that. But I have to say, of all the hundreds of people I interviewed about this, that's pretty well the average soldier's view. And who can blame them, in my view?
The senior officers, like Pinky Hutchinson, as you refer to him,
your favourite,
watched the drafts come and go. And ultimately, he found himself appointed as the acting colonel of the remnants of the 2nd Fife and 4th Fife Yeomanry. And Major Douglas Hutchinson says this: during the summer, those who were not due for early release, all the younger or more recently joined members of the regiment, were drafted into the 1st Fife and 4th Fife Regiment. They in turn sent us their people, like the remainder of us who were due for early release. The idea being that having achieved this, the 2nd Fife and 4th Fife would be in due course disbanded. Colonel Scott was given an appointment commanding a regiment. It may have been his own regiment, the Inniskilling Dragoons. He was a regular soldier. He left the regiment and for a few months I was paid as an acting lieutenant colonel, which was very reasonable in the circumstances as I didn't have very much to do.
Good old Pinky Hutchinson. Now, as the year goes on, you know, May, June, July, as you're moving on, the threat of war against being involved in the war is gone with the atomic bombs and peace in August 1945. So what do you think the men's minds turn to, Gary? What would your mind have turned to? Sex, drugs and rock and roll, but
you think so little of me. Demobilisation. The army was keen to help as best it could in preparing them for a renewal of civilian life.
There are courses, there are education, there's sport, there's all sorts of things. But gradually, the regiment just erodes away. There's demobilisation parties, which are fantastic booze-ups sometimes. But you can imagine what it's like, old faces disappearing, and soon there's hardly anybody left. So who is last man standing?
Well, fittingly, a Dundee recruit from 1939, then a trooper, but now an officer, Alex Gilchrist, was the man charged with winding up the 2nd Fife and 4th Fife Yeomanry on the final official day of existence, which was 9th of January 1946.
And this is what Alex said. There are only about 40 to 50 of us that are left in the regiment. I was acting adjutant by that time, and it was a matter of being in constant contact with the brigade headquarters to see what the next move was. We had to get rid of all of the vehicles. I had fellows driving to Husum and Schleswig. The regiment was just being run down completely. Eventually, I was told by Brigadier Monkey Blacker that I had to get all the records packed up in big steel boxes and return them to brigade headquarters. The day came. That was the end of the unit. I was left with about 14 or 15 vehicles, and I had to get rid of them. Brigade didn't want them. Division didn't want them. I thought, what the hell can I do with them? I found there was a big old quarry not so far away. It was filled with water. I lined up those vehicles, put them in first gear, and just let them simply roll into the water. Believe you me, half the farmers from all round were there within a few minutes. They had tractors, and these vehicles were pulled out again within half an hour and put to their own use. And that's a classic British Army.
Now, Gilchrist, or Alex, as you call him...
Oh, I did know him, remember?
Yeah, went off to serve the rest of his time with the Inns of Court Regiment on the Danish border, and he himself was demobilised in May 1946.
Now, demob's what the men are wishing for, isn't it? It's absolutely... that it's the centre of their lives. Everything's... it's going to be perfection. It's the end of all problems and troubles, isn't it?
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's not always what they wanted when they actually got back into civilian life.
Why? What's the problem?
Well, most returned to the jobs they'd left in the harsh economic climate of the past post-war world. There's little choice. But they've often had to bite their lips as they witness colleagues who've not gone to war, for whatever reason, now promoted to managerial positions far above them. They'd lost several years of their working life, crucial years that were difficult to catch up.
Do you remember this from the South?
I remember exactly this.
The reason that this is coming up is this is happening all over the bloody country. Now, one example of this is John Thorpe. He was a cracking lad. No need for any unit title because they're civilians now. And tell us what John Thorpe said.
In June 1944, I went to France weighing over 13 stone, fighting fit. I came back from there weighing barely 9 stone, a gaunt shadow of my former self. Generally, my feelings were to forget all about it. No one wanted to contact me or wanted to know, and no one cared. I'd done what I had to do. I'd lost 6 years of my life. I'd expended too much of my drive. It was an awful ordeal to find my niche, to pick up where I had been. I returned to the county council, a very small fry in a big sea. No concessions were made for the 6 years I'd been away. I was placed on a grade as if I was just starting a job with them. I didn't expect much, but felt a bit of a twit as a junior. I had lost a lot of work experience, and now the war was over, I had no concessions in the professional exams. I would have to take all subjects at once and pass at the same time. Our old promotion routes had been filled, and we should have to take a back seat. I was not welcomed back. Thus, I settled back to civilian life.
Now, this is this. For some reason, I find this really. I suppose I knew somebody. I find this really quite heartrending, and I can imagine how frustrated they were. And there must have been many people who just couldn't cope with it. I mean, what could they do?
Well, often they thrashed around endlessly, changing their jobs, seeking something that they could never quite define. And this is again. No unit. Len Newman. And this is what Len says.
I went in the army as an 18-year-old, knew nothing about anything, came out as a married man who'd been away from home for 3.5 years. With great difficulty, there I was, been away in the army for a few years. We were promised our civvy jobs back. Could you really imagine me going back as a junior clerk at Purley's? That's his old workplace. Like a lot of people, I had a hell of a job to settle down. I really did. I went to work on the railway first, electrical work. Hated it. Then I went to the offices of the railway, engineers department. A bit better. I think a lot of people from the services had a real job to settle down. We missed the camaraderie, the comradeship we got used to. We were all reliant on each other. We looked after each other. We were happy together. And that's what we missed. Yeah. And a lot of comradeship they talk about. I mean, you are still in various WhatsApp groups with your comrades. And that wasn't a fighting war you were in. That was just being in the army and the comradeship mattered.
Yeah, absolutely. And even today, people still say that's one of the things they miss. That's why they join associations and groups, you know.
Yeah.
Now, this is John Gray, who returned to his pre-war work behind the counter of his... local cooperative grocers.
Now, he's a funny bloke, isn't he? I mean, I'm not saying he's not weird, but he's a man who liked to see the funny side of things. He was a bit more left-wing than most people of that time. But he also missed the comradeship of the army. What did he say, Gary?
You're 18, an impressionable age. You lived, you ate, you fought, and you died with these fellows. Well, they died, I lived. It was like a big family. There was always somebody to help you if you needed it. If there was anything wrong at home or anything like that. It was an incredible thing. I think the word they used is camaraderie. You were all mates together. When I came out, there was this feeling of emptiness. I was leaving it all behind. I didn't really want to. It's most peculiar. It was horrible. I don't know. You seem to be at your wit's end all the time. You got easily aggravated, bad-tempered. It was all the things I wasn't when I went in. I was when I came out. I think it was what helped to ruin my first marriage.
Was that you or the person, the last bit?
No, that was him saying that.
Gotcha.
Now, as you mentioned, he was always on the left politically, and Gray becomes an activist with both his trade union and Labour Party because he's trying in some way to improve the quality of life for ordinary people, including himself.
Including himself, yeah.
And this is what John Gray says. We were being told all the time in the army that we were fighting for better things, a country fit for heroes to live in. Well, I was one of the heroes and I wanted it fit for me. I went out of my way to make it like that, for me and anyone else that required it. If people didn't have the brains to do it for themselves, I'd do it for them.
Now, there's a tinge of arrogance there, isn't it? But
tinge?
I don't know. I still like him. Now, another character, Len Harkins. Now, in the book, there's loads of stories about Len Harkins. His basic reaction to anything was if anybody crossed him in any way, he'd thump him. At one point, he nearly thumps Pinky Hutchinson, which would have been at the end of his career.
But the war acted as a jolt, and that set him on a more measured path through life. And I can sort of relate to that. I wasn't very pleasant when I was a young 16-year-old.
You were harem scared,
and now I'm
you?
Lovely.
You are lovely now. Yes, I agree. And this is what Len Harkin said. When I thought I was lucky enough to pull through, I never thought I was getting out of Normandy. But when you think, Christ, that was near, I said to myself then, if I ever come through this, I'll bloody work day and night, which I did. And he turned the corner. He ran several successful enterprises. It wasn't in the most respectable of trades. It was in the horse trade, buying and selling horses. I suppose that's respectable enough. And he made a success of his life. There you go. Now, who else? We're going through some of the big characters we've talked about. Who stands above, in my view, almost above all as a character?
You're referring to William Steele Brownlee. And for him, the end of the war must have been a real challenge. Having been rescued from the prospect of service in the Far East, he had an inconsequential job as second in command of an HQ squadron with the 22nd Armoured Brigade in Schleswig-Holstein until his demobilisation in late 1946.
Now, the question that for us, I never knew him, you never knew him, but we've read his account and we've gone through what he said. Do you think it's possible that civilian life could ever match up to the frenzied excitement of leaving, like in Operation Blue Coat, where he's leading his troop, charging down those roads, brassing up the side, fighting German tanks here, there, and there, could be dead any minute. Do you think anything in civilian life could match that, Gary?
No.
Was that a rhetorical question?
Yes.
Are you going to ask me what rhetorical means?
No. Now, he went back to university and graduated in French and German in 1950.
Can we have some examples of French and German?
Merde.
And German?
Pimmel.
Wow!
Then a career as a language teacher in Renfrewshire, although he could not quite stay away from the army as he served for many years with the local territorials, the Ayrshire Yeomanry.
Yeah, and he wrote their regimental history. And I quote some of it. It's a fantastic book.
What's it called?
It's called The Proud... Honestly, chums, you should buy this if you see. It's about £30 usually. The Proud Trooper. The history of the Ayrshire Yeomanry from its raising in the 18th century to 1964. A title that stirs the blood, I think.
And that's available from, or it's Second published out. Rather, Second by Collins of London in 1964.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is a cracking book, especially on the First and Second World War.
Now, there is another rhetorical question. Did he ever really settle down? Now, perhaps best to quote his own last words in his memoirs and Came Home Safe, which was written in 1989, and this is William Steele Brownlee.
Yes. Adjustment was difficult, but also necessary, and from the back of my mind come words that were often heard during the war. What do you do in real life? Well, civilian life may have been real, but it was a lot less exciting. And with that, I want you to think about that, Gary, and let's have a period of silence while you think.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
There were post-war success stories. Tom Hild went back to study law at university, leading to a successful career as a barrister and then a judge.
Yeah, I remember interviewing him in a lovely house outside Nottingham. Great, lovely man, great chap. And he's another officer who used to lead the... Remember he told us about charging down the roads, brassing up and getting out of the tank to pull Germans out of Slithridge. That could have been his last action.
Now... Meanwhile, Alex Gilchrist returned to his pre-war work in the sales office of a printing firm, where he found that his war experiences had broadened his outlook and made him realise what he was capable of.
Yeah, and it worked, because he got a lot more self-confidence. And I don't know how, he found that he did get promoted, so he got some recognition and he had a successful career. There are some people who it doesn't really matter what they do. Let's have an example of that. And That's not to denigrate this man, because I actually have the highest regard for him. Who am I talking about?
Well, you're referring to the wealthier officers for whom the war was merely an interruption in their pre-war careers. And therefore, Sir John Gilmore returned to work in the brewing industry before succeeding in becoming a Conservative Party Member of Parliament for East Fife from 1961 to 1979. He was actually Lord Lieutenant of Fife from 1980 to 1987.
And he was a cracking bloke.
But he still found time for the Fife and Forfar Yeomanry. He rejoined them on their reformation as an armoured car reconnaissance unit and acting as their colonel from 1947 to 1950.
Now, the other one who was wealthy and a personal favourite of mine, and I really do remember interviewing him, Pinky Hutchison. He lived in Aberfeldy or Keldy, I can't remember which it is. But he was another, he was rich. What did he do?
He returned to his prosperous family business and became Colonel of the Fife and Forfar Yeomanry in succession to Sir John Gilmore from 1950 to 1953.
Now, for others, their experience in the Second Fifty Forfars changed everything about their lives. And one such was Roy Vallance. Now, what had Roy done before the war? Let's have a look at that.
Well, he'd been a printer before joining up, but the army became his life's work. He became a regular soldier and saw even more active service with the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars in Korea in 1951.
Yeah, and that I think there's actually as much about that in the interview I did with him as there is about the... Because remember, that for us, we're focusing on the Second World War, but the Korean War is a big thing as well. Cracking bloke.
He had the honour of being the first regimental sergeant major on the amalgamation of his regiment with the 4th Queen's Own Hussars to form the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars.
He was ultimately commissioned. He was a major when I interviewed him. It's a classic thing of he's not a proper officer. Yeah. Can you guess, Gary? Can you guess?
Was he a quartermaster?
Quartermaster in 1959. And as quartermaster, served in Germany, Aden and Malaya. And he was finally medically discharged in 1971.
Wow.
What a career. That's something. Now, there's others who wanted to become a regular soldier, but the war puts a bloody stop to that. And when I say bloody stop to that, I mean bloody. What do I mean?
Well, this is Alf Courtmidge, and he says this. It was unfortunate that I was wounded, but I think had I not been, I would have stayed on as a soldier, I think. I did begin to enjoy it.
Now, I don't know whether we talked about him in the podcast, but it's certainly in the book. I don't have a very good memory, as you know, Gary. He'd crushed his hand and left hip bone. That's bad. Had been smashed by shrapnel during Operation Goodwood. That was in July 18th, 1944. And he'd had a series of operations, but he was still incapacitated at the end of the war. He wasn't required for the army and was discharged on medical grounds. It sounds cruel, but on the other hand, the army can't look after everybody. What does he get when he comes out?
Well, he's given a disability pension, but he anticipated that at least he could resume his training as a bricklayer. But unfortunately, even that was denied him.
That, and to be honest, that given his injury, I can see what's going
on. I can understand that, yeah. And this is once more Alf Courtmidge. I had hoped to have come out and continue as a bricklayer because there was such a lot of war damage. It would have been a good thing to have done. But I really didn't know what one could do. There was a lot of demolition about, which I couldn't do because of my hand and my side. To be quite honest, it really did start knocking the confidence out of me. I wasn't able to play football. I couldn't play cricket. Whereas you saw other people coming out of the services and going back and doing the normal things you do when you're 21, 22 years of age.
You can just imagine, you know, everybody playing football, cricket, having a good life. And there's you, semi-crippled.
And at that age, yeah. I mean, you forget about how young these chaps were.
Well, 30 seems young to us. And these guys are 21, 22, as he said. Now, eventually it goes into the fur trade. That he'd worked in that a little bit for a short while before the war. And it's just lighter work, less physical demands. His hand was operated on and was rebuilt with the aid of a skin graft. I don't know how all that worked, but he never really got full use of it again. Terrible. But he's a real fighter, isn't he? What does he do? This is inspiring, I think. Whenever we think this, we've got something wrong, we should think about people like Courtney.
Well, he studied hard to improve his qualifications and eventually had a successful career as a director of the company. But the shadow of the war remained over his whole life. And this is, once more, Alf Courtney. I was not very happy. My walking was restricted, as it still felt as if the hip was not a complete unit anymore. I was having nightmares, more of the pain one had suffered. Nowadays, if these things happen, you get counselling. Well, in our day, there was no counselling. It was never thought of. Fortunately, they didn't last a long while, and gradually it eased off. I suppose one accepts these things. You overcome these things.
Now, this is another inspirational story, but it's also a tragic story that it happened to him in the first place. James Donovan had been very badly facially wounded. He'd basically lost his nose. He was in a terrible state, and he went back to work as a driver at a laundry and then went on to be a coach driver. Now, let's hold that thought for a while. He has to cope Gary, with a lasting physical facial disfigurement. Do you think plastic surgery would help?
Well, it would help, but it would still be obvious. But he had his own method of coping, and this is what James Donovan said.
And I remember him telling me this, exactly this. He said, it was a strange thing. It just depends on the person. They look at you and they see what they want to see. Children were the worst at first. They used to call you Rudolph, as in red-nosed reindeer, raspberry nose, or strawberry nose. But I found if you said, come here and I'll tell you all about it, they were all right once you'd told them, explained it all to them. That was the end of it. I thought the best thing I can do is not hide away, but to get amongst people. I got a PSV. Is that a...
Public service vehicle, bus license.
You've got one of them.
I do.
And became a coach driver, which that's why I mentioned it when you mentioned it, which meant I was mingling with different people every job I went on. You met different people every day. Some people would notice it, some wouldn't. Some would say, cool, you've been in the walls, mate. And that's it. You do feel as if people look at you, stare at you. But a lot of that is in your mind. You've got to get to the stage where you think to yourself, I'm not going to change things, so I've got to make the best of what I've got. I looked at people who'd lost their sight and I think to myself, thank God that wasn't me. It never stopped me doing anything I wanted to do. Sometimes it's embarrassing because I can't feel when I've got a dewdrop. It means hanging off the end of his nose. And I think that's a lovely final touch that, you know, you've got your nose smashed up and your rebuilt nose.
Well, however, Donovan, like so many of the people that you interviewed, had nightmares about the war, which I would hazard is sometimes triggered by the prospect of oral history interviews, particularly with you, which reawakened old memories, the old traumas.
Now, this is James again, James Donovan. I do get a bad night now and again. You just get a flashback. You dream about these things. I had one on Saturday night, two nights ago. That's just one of these things. Something just triggers you. And in that case, it was me.
It was you, yeah.
And this is one of the things when people say about oral history. The people who do these interviews are not only giving their time, but they're uncovering a lot of things that they might have tried to suppress. It's absolutely, I've got so much.
Well, one way of looking at it, I suppose, is that they're giving the whole of themselves, which, you know, often they have hidden in order to cope.
Yeah.
Now, the very thought of a regimental association was anathema to many of the old soldiers of the 2nd, 5th and 4th Yeomanry once they'd got home.
Yeah, they were sick of the army and they were craving civilian life. They may have missed comradeship, but at the same time, they don't want to be regimented. They don't want blazers, ties. This is all crap to them.
Not anathema then.
No, especially in the years immediately following the end of the war. What else is on their mind?
Well, they're busy trying to re-establish the civilian lives that they had, studying for qualification and trying to ameliorate the effects of having been absent from their work careers for up to 6 years, as was mentioned earlier.
Yeah, well, that's a big thing. So they're trying to catch up. So they've got no time for distractions.
Now, unfortunately, many of the non-Scottish veterans, they weren't even asked. It seems it was out of sight, out of mind.
But in no, I just want to say before we start, this sounds critical, but actually in those days, it was much, there were no WhatsApp groups.
No,
there's no,
it was much
Facebook.
More difficult.
You had to write a bloody letter and post it.
And distance was distance.
And people didn't have money for cost of phone calls. This is Jeff Hayward. He said, the attitude of most of the troops when they were anxiously waiting for demobilisation was, when I get out of the army, I wouldn't even join two pieces of string together. That was the expression that sticks in my mind. During the regimental days, I'd found that because the regiment tended to exude a sort of family atmosphere to the ones that were in it right from the start, I never really felt that I would want to join an association of that type. He means he doesn't want to be a beer. Basically, I didn't even know there was a Scottish association. Nobody had approached me to join one. And it's fair enough.
I was supposed to read that.
Oh, well, I've done it for you.
Yeah, I'll do the ones later on, though, eh?
Yeah?
Yeah. Now, it was different for some of the Scots, particularly those who had risen through the ranks to hold responsible positions in the regiment, such as Tommy Wilmot, who had risen to the regimental quartermaster sergeant. Now, with his proven administrative skills and widespread contacts in the regiment, he was the obvious choice to be involved in setting up the association to cope with the influx of Second World War soldiers, which was going to be added to the existing spine of veteran members dating back to the Great War.
And you've got to remember, those, they're not 80 or 90. Those veteran members are in their late 40s and 50s. They're not that old.
And this is Tommy Wilmot, which is you.
It's me. Sorry about that last one. Tommy said this. He had a fine Dundee accent. When we came back in February 1946, not many had been demobbed before me, but they were started to be demobbed quickly, and they were all coming back. There was a chap in the first Fife and Forfar, Captain Robertson. He was the manager of a savings bank. He says, "There are some people wanted to contact us, Tom. Three businessmen in Dundee who were in the First World War. They got us together and they said, what you must do is form an association now. Right now. Get it organised, because the longer you wait, the harder it will be." We formed a committee and we had our first dinner in April 1946. The regiment came and we had a supper dinner. We decided it was important to keep an annual dinner every year, and we've had one every single year in Dundee right up to and including 1999. I think it was at that one. It's been invaluable. They say old soldiers never die, but there it is. They do.
Super or supper dinner?
Super.
Oh. Now, for Leslie Gibson, you're going to be working so hard now.
I think that might have been supper.
For Leslie Gibson, the association became an important part of his life. And this is Leslie Gibson, who, because of your faux pas, you're now going to read another one.
I joined the association in 1946 when it started again. That means the association. I was at the very first dinner, perhaps the 6.5 years you spent in the army. That you feel in many respects were 6.5 years out of your life. But in many ways, it was a good 6.5 years. All times during the war weren't bad. There were a lot of good times. You would never get comradeship like it anywhere else, I'm quite sure. There was something about it that gelled people together. You learned to get on with people. You learned you could do things. I wouldn't have swapped it. We have reunion dinners, and it's so great to meet up with blokes you haven't met up with for a long time and just talk about the old times. And there you go. I noticed on one of your WhatsApp threads that you sent me that your lads from the were talking about organising a reunion. And if you think about it, it's 30 or 40 years since, and it's time. Because at your age, Gary, if you don't do it now, you'll never do it.
Yeah, it's 40-odd years since. Yeah.
And it's tough. And also in the same thread, someone had died.
Yeah, that's true. Now, one moment at an association dinner summed up the old ties that bound them. So much so that when we interviewed the three men concerned, you mean the Imperial War Museum them, they all treasured the memory. And this is once more Alex Gilchrist. Yeah. You're doing lots of work.
They all talked about it. And Alex said, on the 60th anniversary of us joining the Territorial Regiment in April 1939, that's April 1999, I was invited specially to come up for this. It was a marvellous thing in Dundee on 16th of April, exactly 60 years since we were attested and joined up after the war. I met people like Jock Crichton, a great friend of mine. Les Gibson, he's the one I was just doing. Bill Scott, I interviewed him as well. All of whom I'd been in the territorials with. We were all seated at the same table. Bill stood up and said, "Do you realise why we're all sitting together?" I said, "No." Probably not in that tone. He said, "Because we were the first guard the regiment ever mounted at Waitwith Camp on 14th of April 1939. And here is the four of us still alive." We then had our photographs taken. Fall in the old guard 60 years later. Fabulous. Fabulous.
Now, meanwhile, back in England, Jeff Haywood had hated the thought of returning to work as an insurance clerk, but he had no other feasible options.
So what did he do? He stuck with it.
Well, he got stuck in and eventually ended up with a successful stint as a chief clerk based in Leeds and Bradford.
Yeah.
He was totally immersed in his career and his new life, but with retirement came a long overdue assessment of what had been really important to him over the years, what had really mattered.
Well, that happened to me when I retired from the Imperial War Museum and I really put all my energies into those naughty lumps.
I thought you meant me and these podcasts.
No, those naughty lumps, I've been really working hard, Gary, on them.
Now, Jeff Hayward found himself thinking more and more of his old comrades in the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry. Now, he attended the Dundee dinner of the Scottish Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry Association held in November 1995. And this really kick-started something. And this is what Jeff Hayward says. We talked about
his
forming.
His voice has changed.
He's from the south. We talked about forming some little south of the border group that could meet occasionally for all those who couldn't afford or want to go to the Scottish Dues because of the distance. I said, I'll start the ball rolling. I'll write a letter to all the people I know in England that can't get up to these Scottish dinners. This idea grew from a very small beginning. We thought the best we could hope for was perhaps a dozen, but it's now grown and we've got 80. It is important to get people weaving with the idea of preserving their memories.
And I'd like to pay tribute to Jeff Hayward because it was the south of the border group and the fact that they existed, which rendered it economically possible for the War Museum to do a project on the south, on the 54.
Is Jeff Hayward still alive?
He's the only one other than Harold Wilson, a different Harold Wilson, who is still alive from any of them. And he's a fantastic bloke. But he gave us some membership in this. And so that's why we interviewed so many. So we still interviewed a lot of the Scots, but half the regiment was English, Welsh and anything else you like by the end. So let's have more work for you. John Gray. Now, he's one of those. Perhaps he wouldn't have responded positively in 1952 or whatever, but he really responds positively to Jeff Hayward when he gets news of this. It's out of the blue for him, isn't it? And what does John Gray say?
After that, nothing. Suddenly, I'm looking at the freebie newspaper and down in the corner was this little notice, south of the border. I've never moved so fast in all my life as to get onto that phone number. Speaking to the association secretary, I said, I thought everyone was dead. I thought I was the last one alive. It was absolutely incredible after all those years that there were still Fife and Forfers going. Although I don't know any of them. The problem is, I might well have sat in a tank with them, sat and ate my food with them. But then, when you look at my photograph back then, and you look at me now, I don't look anything like it. I'm still handsome, suave and debonair, but I certainly don't look like that. I've got a few wrinkles now, and they're the same.
So what he means is he doesn't recognise someone who's 50 years old. I mean, he knew him at 20, 21, and now they're 71, 72, 73. And he doesn't recognise them. But they soon got to know him,
I can sympathise with that because you might find this hard to believe. I don't look like I looked when I was 17, 18 years old in the army.
Were you an ugly sod?
I was 9 stone, 2 pound boxing. So I was one of my legs, basically.
What was your best feature?
My legs. Now, people often trot out the tired old cliche that old soldiers didn't like to talk about it.
Well, there's a reason for this, and this is the oral historian in me. For relatives, it's relatives who say this, I think there's two reasons for it. Can you imagine what they are?
Well, one, it excuses their failure to listen to the tedious repetition of old war stories. It's the old Uncle Albert character, isn't it?
From Only Fools and Not, yeah. Oh, God, give it a rest, Grandad. You told us that 100 times. Yeah, yeah. But also, there's something else it means. What else do you think it does? If you don't, he didn't like to talk about it, what else does that imply?
Well, it implies that the veterans had seen too much and it generates a spurious second-hand glamour.
Oh, they're the son of a war hero, but he doesn't like to talk about it and he can't. The 544 were war heroes, by the way. I don't want to undermine that, but then again, there's something else that stops veterans talking a lot about their wartime careers. And I want you to think back to some of those tank stories at, say, Goodwood. Why else might they not have wanted to talk about it?
Well, not only would their families not interested, but the stories that they were telling were perhaps not suitable for the young kids. But they did like to talk about it when given half a chance.
So where'd
they
get the chance?
Well, they spoke about it to fellow veterans at the British Legion or best of all, to their old comrades in the regimental associations.
Yeah, and there they've got, they can relive their youth, can't they? They can refight old battles. They can remember old friends dead long before their time. I always, that was a phrase that stuck in my mind. They all thought they would be dead before they were 30. Well, before they were 25. And now they're 80 and their friend's been dead for 60 years. Dead long before their time. And most of them never really forgot what they'd experienced together. And let's go to Steele Brownlee for a quote. And this last quote is just, for me, awesome. Out of all the mishmash of memories I have, one that is vivid when I walk the dog of an evening. If the wind is blowing quietly through the trees and everything else is still, I physically feel what it was like to be in a field in Normandy at the end of a day. Not mentally, just physically. It's a strange feeling. And you can just imagine walking through the field and suddenly just gets that physical touch with it.
Now, the voices of most, if not all, of the second
well,
five
Jeff's
four
still alive.
Yeomanry men featured in your book.
Yeah, what
have,
book?
That'll be
I'll be coming to that.
Burning Steel. Most of them have now been silenced, but we will remember them.
We will remember them. It's not just a cliche. I think one of the reasons we're so keen on this podcast series is because we are remembering them and we want other people to remember them. They're a fabulous bunch. Collectively, they were proud of what they'd achieved, but they weren't boastful, were they?
No. So let the last word be from one of the amazing, ordinary yet extraordinary men, John Thorpe. I can say that I met the enemy face to face and I fired a machine gun at him for more days than I care to think about it. But it was all chance. My country was fighting for her life. It could have happened to any man in Britain. It was my fate. I was a conscript. I did not object. Someone had to fight this war. I did what I had to do. I did not want to dodge the issue.
Well, and that, for me, that stands for all of the lads we've been talking through. What a great bunch they were. and we hope you've enjoyed this series. There will be another regimental series. We're going to do a peacetime one on the South Notts Hussars in peacetime. That's going to start in a month or two. And there'll probably be one on the 16th Durham Light Infantry in the distant future, because that's the book I'm working on at the moment. But let the last word be with John Thorpe and the Fight for Four Fire Yeomanries. We never learned how to say it.
Now, at risk of having the last word, I would take this opportunity to remind the listeners that they can get the book, Burning Steel, A Tank Regiment at War 1939-1945, by Peter Hart.
That's me.
Available at all good bookshops, some not so good, but it is freely available at the moment.
And it's cheap these days.
Yeah. Bit like you, Pete.
It is. Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?